World War III has already begun and is being fought piecemeal around the world. That's how Pope Leo began his first overseas trip as Pope, visiting Turkey and then later on Lebanon. We'll also have the latest on America's judicial wars, Germany's coalition chaos, and peace in the Middle East, and much more on today's Trumpet World.
Today, more than ever, we need people who will promote dialogue and practice it with firm will and patient resolve. In the aftermath of the tragedies of two world wars, which saw the building of large international organizations, we are now experiencing a phase marked by heightened level of conflict on the global level, fueled by prevailing strategies of economic and military power. This is enabling what Pope Francis called a third world war fought piecemeal. We must in no way give in to this. The future of humanity is at stake.
That was Pope Leo after arriving in Turkey and meeting with the Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan yesterday. The two discussed plans to bring peace to Israel, with Erdogan praising Leo's astute stance on the Palestinian issue. And I think if the Turkish president thinks you have an astute stance on anything in the Middle East, you're probably wrong. But anyway, today, on Friday, the Pope will focus on healing divisions in the Christian world. He'll be celebrating the 1700th anniversary of the Council of Nicaea alongside Eastern Christian leaders. This is a story that touches on Europe, on the Middle East. Andrew wrote an article on it earlier this week. So I thought I'd begin by getting all of our panel involved. Well, ahead of this trip that began yesterday, Pope Leo issued a new letter about the Council of Nicaea. And so, Andrew, maybe you could begin by telling us about that letter, seeing as you had an article on Monday on it, and how it set the scene for this trip.
Yes, Pope Francis did write an apostolic letter just commemorating the 1700th anniversary of the Council of Nicaea. And before I talk too much about it, I'll just give a quick recap about what the Council of Nicaea was. That was really a landmark council in Roman Catholic history back in the year 325 AD. Leading up to it, the Roman Empire had been vivaciously persecuting Christians of all beliefs and denominations. That came to an end when Emperor Constantine I came to power. He issued his famous Edict of Toleration, the Edict of Milan, in 313. Looked like he was going to be very tolerant of Christian beliefs until a doctrinal dispute rose over the nature of the Trinity. That doctrinal dispute not only was dividing the Christian world, people held their beliefs so fervently that it looked like it could bring about quite a bit of civil unrest, rioting, protest, and division in the Roman Empire. So Constantine, who was on his way to becoming a Christian himself, called a council, and for the first time in Christian history, acted as a head of state moving to enforce doctrine. That's why I think the quip on my my article on this earlier this week was Roman Catholic Church marks 1700 years of church-state unity. Because this was really the point in history where it's no longer Christians just believing the Bible as they understand it or following the dictates of their conscience, but it was very much the Roman Empire coming in, endorsing certain doctrines and exiling all those who didn't believe in them. But as Pope Leo points out in this letter, it really was a time after Constantine made these decisions of more Christian unity. More unity by force, because all those who didn't agree with the council were exiled or persecuted. But they did sign this Nicene Creed that both Roman Catholics, Eastern Orthodox, and most of the mainstream Protestant denominations agree on. So it's kind of like this Nicene Creed, it's kind of like the largest common denominator for what we could call mainstream traditional Christianity. The Roman Catholics, the Eastern Orthodox, the Anglicans, the Lutherans, like the Methodists, most of the Calvinists, believe in this doctrine. So Pope Leo is pointing back to it as a like the solution to Christian division, saying that in the Roman Catholic worldview, all there's many churches who are, in their view, protesting or rebelling against Rome, but they believe that all who believe in the Trinity, all who affirm this Nicene Creed, are Christians. So Pope Leo is pointing back to that nostalgically as a symbol of unity, but he's also glossing over the elephant in the room, which is the fact that this wasn't a time when just all the Christians got down and sat down and settled their difference and unanimously came to a conclusion about what Jesus and the apostles actually taught. This was very much a church allying with the state to force religious beliefs. And so pointing back to that, talking about how the Eastern Orthodox and the Protestants and the other churches involved in the ecumenical movement need to rally around Nicaea, that will promote a certain sense of nostalgia from these other groups and the Anglicans and the Lutherans and the Greek Orthodox, who also believe in the Creed of Nicaea and promote some unity that way. But it's also like you read between the lines and it's saying that by endorsing what Constantine did, is saying that we really need an alliance between church and state to bring about Christian unity in the world. It's not like the founding fathers in the United States where they put their first and most important amendment as Congress shall make no law regarding the establishment of religion. These figures back at Nicaea that the Pope's pointing to as great examples of Christian history were people who definitely believe that the Roman Empire should make laws regarding the establishment of religion, even to the point of exiling all those who don't agree.
Yeah, it was a fascinating piece of misdirection where you read his letter and you kind of, like, he does give the impression that it gradually coalesced to unity and it was all a very peaceful and wonderful process, and completely misses out that they used the sword of the state to enforce this. And I think it's also fascinating to see this discussion in light of what I want to talk about later in Europe, in Germany. You know, we've talked for years about the prophesied rise of a German strongman. And now this is the Pope basically saying, well, he called it a model. Nicaea is a model for how we bring unity to the Catholic Church. If that's a model, well, then you need a Constantine. You need a Roman emperor to put in place that model. So, that's right. I mean, this is a big part of the reason we're watching this, and we're watching this trip is very specific Bible prophecies about church unity. And maybe you could talk about more of that in just a second with what's perhaps planned for over the weekend. I know you've been preparing to write on this for a while for our Trumpet print edition, but then we've also been very specific about how they'll achieve that unity. And ultimately it will come down to using secular authority to force those that wouldn't go along voluntarily to unify with the Catholic Church. And it will be very much a my way or the highway, or worse, my way or death. Ultimately, you've got to conform or here's the penalty. So this is Bible prophecy in action. But then on that point, this is what the Pope will be doing today with the 1700th anniversary of Nicaea. What are you seeing or expecting on the front of church unity from this trip?
He's also got several other meetings planned over the weekend. I think he's got a sermon planned in the Hagia Sophia. He's planning to meet privately with Archbishop Bartholomew of the Eastern Orthodox Church. I'll be very interested to see what announcements come out of this. My expectation is that since Pope Leo does not currently have a Constantine to help him enforce doctrinal policies, that most of his sermons and meetings are going to be more of the same of what we've read in his letter, just lionizing the history of Nicaea, trying to stir up nostalgia over Nicaea, pointing people back to Nicaea. And then behind the scenes, there's discussions about what compromises church can make. They don't have a Constantine to enforce it, so they are still talking about some compromises. Maybe I'm wrong. I don't know if Pope Leo is going to be able to announce any big compromises over this weekend. He's got theological commissions doing some pretty in-depth negotiations, especially with the Eastern Orthodox Church right now, on how to bring about full unity. I think right now the three main sticking points with the Eastern Orthodox Church is papal primacy, the date of Easter, and a phrase called the filioque. I'll talk about that one first. The filioque, that's a Latin word.
Is it the filioque or is it the filioque?
Filioque, yeah, filioque. My Latin's horrible, but it means from the Son. The initial Nicene Creed that everyone signed in 325 AD described what the church believed about the Trinity, and it said the Holy Spirit proceeded from the Father, and had several verses backing that up. Later, the Roman Catholic Church added this Latin word in there, saying it proceeded from the Father and the Son, and that has marked a big doctrinal difference between Eastern Orthodoxy and the Latin Church. With the one saying the Holy Spirit proceeds from the Father only, the other saying it proceeds jointly from the Father and the Son. I didn't get a chance to read the latest proposal in depth. I did see an article this morning speculating that Pope Leo might just delete that word, filioque. It was added after the fact and everyone knows it. So if you can actually delete it and just publish the original Nicene Creed and then let people privately believe on their own whether it proceeds from the Father alone or the Father and the Son, that would be a gesture that could help unity with the Eastern Orthodox Church. There's another commission talking about papal primacy. The Eastern Orthodox Church split from the Roman Catholic Church at the time where there were five archbishops: Rome, Constantinople, Alexandria, Antioch, and Jerusalem. And there was an agreement that the Pope of Rome had primacy of honor amongst them, but he was definitely not regarded as infallible. So the Catholic doctrine of papal infallibility, which was only actually formalized at the First Vatican Council about 150 years ago, is another sticking point they're going to have to iron out before unity. And then the last and most embarrassing one, I think, for them is the date of Easter. Of course, the Bible tells us to celebrate Passover on the 14th of Nisan on the Jewish calendar, no matter where it falls. At Nicaea, they decide to celebrate it the first Sunday after the spring equinox. And so both churches agree on that, first Sunday after the spring equinox. However, since the Julian calendar they used at the time didn't have leap years, or at least not leap years in the way that we currently do, the spring equinox date shifted pretty far away from when the spring equinox actually is. The Roman Catholic Church fixed that with their Gregorian calendar. The Eastern Orthodox are still using the Julian calendar due to tradition, even though astronomy says it's very, very wrong about when the spring equinox is. So both sides have said that they want a common date of Easter and should be able to figure out one fairly easily if the spring equinox, it's not hard to determine when the spring equinox happens. A high school astronomer could do it. So that's the third big one. But I think these are the three big sticking points. They're trying to do negotiations behind the scenes before the Eastern Orthodox Church and the Roman Catholic Church announce full communion. So I doubt Pope Leo is going to be able to announce anything big on either of those three fronts this weekend. But just lionizing Nicaea might be motivation for those theological commissions to come up with a common understanding, a common compromise on those issues, on the path towards full communion. But as Leo hinted at and didn't say in his letter, if Nicaea's the model, you need a Constantine to, like, whatever compromise they come up with on these issues to come in and say, is like, okay, this is the doctrine, follow it or flee to some other country.
And this unity, I mean, this is something that Herbert W. Armstrong and the Plain Truth wrote about very specifically for decades. And I think that over time, there has been such a remarkable shift here. I mean, this really is an incredible, specific, fulfilled prophecy from the Bible, revealed to Herbert W. Armstrong. He was writing about this before Vatican II. I mean, Vatican II was one of the big moments for the Catholic Church where they changed quite fundamentally how they approached other religions and worked a lot harder to try and draw closer to them and to draw them back to Rome. But he was saying even before that, that you're going to have these groups come back together. So the 1961 Plain Truth said the Pope will step in as the supreme unifying authority, the only one that can finally unite the differing nations of Europe. The iron jurisdiction over both schools and religions will be turned over to the Roman Catholic Church. Europe will go Roman Catholic. Protestantism will be absorbed into the Mother Church and totally abolished. Then a couple of years later, the Plain Truth says, the final, albeit short-lived, triumph of Catholicism is recorded in literally dozens of Bible prophecies. Right now, whether we want to believe it or not, the stage is being set for the greatest revolution in religion the world has witnessed. That article says, the mighty problem of achieving unity is twofold. First, it involves the reconciliation of the Orthodox schism that officially commenced in 1054 and the division of the churches in the East. Second, it involves restoration to the Roman communion, all Protestantism, which developed from 1915 onwards. And since then, we have an article, Returning to the Fold, and a chapter in our He Was Right booklet that goes through even more of these statements and just everything that has changed step by step. And they've come very far already. Like you say, those are the three remaining disagreements as far as the Orthodox world is concerned, and they're pretty minor. They've kind of got to the point where I think in extreme emergencies, like if somebody's on their deathbed, Orthodox and Catholic communions are interchangeable, only in an emergency, but I think they're trying to push towards having common communion. That would be the total goal. But then you've had the Protestant churches massively being moved towards Rome. The most notable symbol of that we had very recently was King Charles III, the head of the Church of England, going and meeting with the Pope and being named the Pope's co-brother and co-defender of this particular part of or this particular chapel that they were at in Rome, or Basilica, sorry. So massive fulfilled prophecy. But also then this is a stepping stone to the major role that the Catholic Church is going to play in the soon coming Holy Roman Empire. Like a unified church and a pope that has just brought Christendom together as a pope with a lot more power, a lot more clout, a lot more soft power and recognition as a leader than any pope that we've seen before. And the person that plays a role in doing that, it may well not be Pope Leo, though he's certainly paving the way in that direction. He's going to help then bring these 10 nations of Europe together in a 10-nation Holy Roman Empire, bring Europe the unity that they've failed to get on their own as part of all of their own negotiations, and then bring Europe much more involved in the Middle East. Bring Europe into what on the surface is marketed as a peace deal in the Middle East and in Israel that's actually going to be the beginning of a new crusade. And I think that brings us to another part of the Pope's trip that prepares the way for that, and that is his discussions with Erdogan, his planned trip to Lebanon next week. So maybe we can bring Simon into the discussion. And Simon, what do you make of kind of more the Middle East politics, say, of Pope Leo's trip?
Well, as you mentioned earlier, they had a discussion about how World War III has already started, and though he didn't mention specifically by name from the transcript, you could tell he had what's going on between Israel and Gaza at least as part of that. I mean, the Office of the Papacy is probably the biggest author, like, everything that the Pope does, every meeting he has, every place he goes is always filled with extremely potent symbolism. And I think the fact that he chose Turkey as his first international trip to speak with President Erdogan about this particular subject speaks volumes. Now, it's true, Pope Francis, the late pontiff, was planning this trip originally, and Leo was just following his schedule, but Leo was made Pope in May. It's November now. He could have had a lot of places to go to for his first trip, which would have attracted a lot of attention, which would have been symbolically interpreted as something his papacy would have focused on. And the fact that he chose to speak with Erdogan, who sponsors Hamas, who used to let Hamas be headquartered in Turkey, to be discussing, who is a dictator in his own right, in his own country, that has turned Turkey away from a democracy, what it used to be, at least partial democracy, into basically an autocracy under his thumb, I think shows, well, A, what he thinks about that kind of government, what you were mentioning before, how celebrating Nicaea implies that Europe, that Catholicism needs its own Constantine, needs its own strong man to start making policy and telling everybody what to do. But I think it also shows what his papacy is going to be focused on going forward. Francis was obviously a very political pope. He was a very antagonistic pope when it comes to Israel. And Pope Leo, with a lot of his words, with a lot of his actions, has followed in that same spirit, if not as blatant as Francis is. To be visiting Erdogan like this, I think, reinforces that. And also what this trip will accomplish later. After he's done with Turkey, he's not flying back to the Vatican. He's going to Lebanon on Sunday. So Turkey is technically the first country he has visited as Pope, but Lebanon will be the first country with a significant Catholic minority in terms of hundreds of thousands of people that he will be visiting, where Catholicism is more of an entrenched religion, where it's part of the historical tradition. Israel just went to war with Hezbollah. Israel invaded Lebanon, as we'll discuss briefly later in this episode. Israel is still carrying out actions in Lebanon and in that part of the world. Okay, that war was with Hezbollah, was with an Islamic terror group, but again, bringing Francis's papacy back into the picture, even without necessarily saying that I am against Israel, the attention he was giving Gaza, the daily phone calls he was giving to the one Gaza church or Catholic church in Gaza, that at least that played quite a role in shaping public opinion against Israel. And if he's going to be picking Lebanon to go to so early on in his papacy at a time like this, again, is part of the same stream and is a good foretaste of what we can expect from Leo's papacy in the months and years to come.
And this, too, is very prophetic. Mr. Flurry had an article in 2014 called Why You Need to Watch Lebanon, and a lot of that article has already been fulfilled. Like he described in that article the way that that Hezbollah would be defeated, that Lebanon would be broken out of Hezbollah's what looked like then a pretty iron grip, and broken out of the Iranian alliance system. And we've seen that happen. Even just this week, you had a bit of a diplomatic bust up between Lebanon and Iran, because Iran said Hezbollah is essential to Lebanon, and Lebanon fired back very almost immediately. No, it's not. We're glad they're gone. The Lebanese president spoke out about that. But in that article, he said, because of its high population of Christian Arabs, Lebanon has become a linchpin for the SAM 83 alliance. So this brings in an alliance that we're watching, that Turkey is going to play a leading role and Lebanon will play a really important role. He said the heavily Christian population, this is Mr. Flurry, makes Lebanon different from the rest of the allied world, of the Arab world. And then he says, by calling on Europe to participate in this deal, it was an arms deal underway back then, designed to protect the Lebanese from Shiite extremism, Saudi Arabia opens the door for a Sunni Catholic alliance. And I think you could say Pope Francis's entire trip is about a Sunni Catholic alliance. He's meeting with some of the most important, well, Erdogan, one of the most important figures in political Islam, and then Lebanon, this part of the Middle East that is especially important for the Catholic Church and for Catholic Europe. So that's a fulfilled prophecy. And Psalm 83 talks about this alliance. You know, it outlines several different countries, and Mr. Flurry talks about this in the King of the South booklet. There's a whole chapter on that. And that Europe is going to lead this alliance ultimately against Israel, or ultimately in a kind of crusade to beat back Shia Islam, to beat back this Iranian-led King of the South. But it's all about control of Jerusalem. So this is another very important part of the Pope's trip. So the two places, the two resources that we've got is the chapter on the mysterious alliance in the King of the South, and then also returning to the fold from He Was Right. Both of these set up this trip in its prophetic context, and I'm sure we'll have a lot more to say about it next week once we've got more details. I think it really is going to be an important news event. So thank you for that, gents. Well, sticking with the Middle East, we've had some very significant peace deals so far with President Trump's peace deal in Hamas, with Hamas in Gaza, and with the new regime in Syria that's been welcomed with open arms to the White House and by world leaders all over the globe. We'll go now to Mihailo Zekic to get a bit of an update on how those peace deals or new leaders are working out.
There's a couple of stories that tie together with those peace deals you were mentioning. On November 25th, Israeli public broadcaster Khan announced that Palestinian Islamic Jihad, the terror group that has been jointly governing Gaza with Hamas, they had their own terrorist army, they held their own hostages from October 7th on. They're consolidating their forces in Palestinian refugee camps in Syria, around the capital, Damascus. The details on what this actually entails are quite murky, but they apparently have at least the tacit blessing of the new government there in Syria. President Shirak, according to the Khan report, is fully aware of what's going on and has even appointed a special presidential envoy to liaison directly between the group and him. PIJ, the terror group, is reportedly doing this because U.S. President Donald Trump has put an unofficial ban on Israel attacking Syria because he wants to have good relations with this new government in Syria. He doesn't want Israel rupturing any budding relations that way. And so PIJ is feeling confident they could rebuild. How much of this is Shirak giving his open support or just feeling powerless to stop him? His power isn't as strong as some people think. We don't know, but either way, he is still letting them do it. When a condition for normalization between him and the states was to expel Palestinian terror groups, and regardless what the reason is, he's not doing that, and the U.S. is still opening relations, as we've discussed on this program before. Another story, this is from last week, but it's only getting reported in the English language media now, is that the IDF and Israeli government had a meeting where the IDF reported that 13 of Gaza's 25 municipalities are full back up and running as if the Israeli invasion never happened. In other words, Hamas is back to its governing position in approximately half of the Gaza Strip. This is as the Gaza ceasefire is progressing forward. They're supposed to start negotiating phase two of that very soon. Phase two calls for Hamas to lay down its arms and proceed to give up governance of the Gaza Strip. They're obviously not going to do that. They said they weren't going to do that before, and now they're backing this up, if this Israeli report is to be believed, with action. And the reason I wanted to cover it on these two stories together was there's a prophecy in Zechariah 14, which we've covered before, about half of Jerusalem falling to a Palestinian takeover. Our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Flurry, has a book with Jerusalem Prophecy that goes into details about that. And you could read that if you'd like to learn more. But the point I want to stress here is that the Bible predicts the Palestinians to get so organized they could even take the capital city from Israel. President Trump stresses that his new deal is going to bring eternal peace, quote-unquote, to the Middle East, as plenty of Israeli commentators, Israeli leaders, saying that Hamas has been finished. There's still some bumps in the road to deal with, but it's going to be a road to good times. The Bible says the exact opposite. The Palestinians are going to get organized, and just looking at the fruits on the ground, they are very much not defeated. They are very much not surrendering. They are very much not interested in peace. They're getting ready for round two, and a lot faster than a lot of people probably would suspect. If people would like to learn more about this particular ceasefire, we have an article in our latest print edition called "This Deal Will Not Bring Eternal Peace" that we could put into the show notes that goes into more detail again.
Thank you very much for that, Mihailo. It certainly is revealing about that the new Syrian government and how genuine any intents of peace that they profess towards Israel are when they're sheltering terrorists like that. Did you have any other stories from the Middle East you wanted to bring us?
I just went over the weekend. Israel struck Lebanon and killed Hezbollah's military chief of staff, the most high profile in the latest series of operations in Lebanon and Syria in the West Bank. Again, Israel's terror war is not going away, and that includes Hezbollah. Hezbollah's trying to rebuild. Israel obviously doesn't like that. And as long as Hezbollah keeps trying to rebuild, we could expect a lot more friction on that front as well.
Thank you for that, Mihailo. Well, we've already heard from Andrew Miller, but we've heard from Andrew Miller, I guess, more in his roving brief, or in he's covered quite a bit on various different Christian news stories over the last year or so. But we'll go back to Andrew Miller now with his hat as correspondent for the English-speaking world, for Anglo-America. What is the main story you have for us this week there?
Well, yeah, that's right. I guess I can claim that the Pope is an American from Chicago, so maybe I can claim the Pope, the head of the Vatican, going to a city in Turkey as an American story. But I'm stretching there. So, in actual American domestic news this week, I think some of the big stories just go involving just the ongoing legal corruption over the Trump administration's attempts to expose the conspirators in the Russiagate collusion hoax. This is something that Trump editor-in-chief Mr. Gerald Flurry has written extensively about in one of his more popular books, America Under Attack, just about the Obama administration and his top officials, James Clapper, John Brennan, James Comey, really just inventing fake intelligence reports to frame Donald Trump for collusion with Russia to keep him out of office. Donald Trump is, miraculously, Donald Trump is back in office now. He's attempting to expose a lot of that corruption. And it looked like he was going to have some good success with us finally getting an indictment on former FBI Director James Comey for lying to Congress, basically perjuring himself to Congress in his testimony over the Russia collusion scandal. And then this indictment was thrown out by a district court judge, Cameron McGowan, who basically is claiming that, not claiming that Comey's innocent or that the indictment itself was unjust, but that the prosecutor who brought about the indictment was unlawfully appointed. And we'll see there, the point about the prosecutor, it is a complicated issue. It's one of those where the previous prosecutor had resigned, and the law says that if a prosecutor resigns or retires, and they need to get a new one before Congress has a chance to appoint a new one, the president can appoint an interim prosecutor for up to 20 days. So the previous one resigned during the Biden administration. Joe Biden appointed his replacement. The replacement refused to prosecute James Comey because the Biden administration protects its own. Then, under pressure to go after Comey, this prosecutor resigned. And Donald Trump's Attorney General Pam Bondi appointed another replacement who actually did get an indictment of Comey on stuff he actually did. Then the district court judge came in and says, like, well, actually that law says that the president can only appoint an interim for up to 120 days. After that, if Congress hasn't appointed an official replacement, it's up to the district court to put in the interim prosecutor. Since the Biden appointee resigned on like the 119th day, and it took the Trump administration a couple days to appoint the replacement, they're now claiming that the 120 days has passed. The Trump administration has no authority to appoint a replacement, and the district court can appoint their replacement until Congress gets around to appointing the official new one. So a lot of legal lawfare going there. I think they're expecting this to go to the Supreme Court. And I know a fair bit about American law, but I'm not even feel like I'm up on like the all the details of this case to actually determine whether Trump's interim replacement was valid or not. I'll defer to the Supreme Court there to determine that. But the big takeaway here is just the fact of how hard it is to get a prosecutor who's even willing to investigate James Comey. Like I said, all these resignations are happening because they're asking them to investigate Comey and they're afraid to do it. So eventually Pam Bondi got someone with the courage and talent to actually go out there and get an indictment over lies he actually told to Congress. And then that was thrown out because they said, okay, well, you appointed that indictment on like the 122nd day after resignation. And there's like a legal loophole here, that seems like maybe that's valid, maybe that's not. And so the district court definitely, most of the judges on that district court are Obama appointees. So they definitely appointed someone who won't go after Comey. And we'll see what happens if the Senate actually gets around to appointing a replacement, but their replacement might not go after him either. So just the fact that it is so hard to even find a judge who will prosecute this case, I think highlights a lot of things that our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Fleury, has written in a number of articles. The one I brought today is called Injustice and Lawlessness, A Prophet's Warning, that mainly goes through prophecies in the book of Micah, just about just how corrupt the justice system in end-time Israel is. And we're definitely seeing huge amounts of judicial corruption with people appointed by Joe Biden or who appointed by Barack Obama who are not actually out for justice, but who are just out to protect these federal agencies like the FBI and the CIA, who really tried to unlawfully frame Donald Trump of crimes he didn't commit so people wouldn't vote for him and vote for the Democratic candidate for the next election, which is election rigging. The current president using the powers they have to have their investigative agencies go after a American citizen running for president and then have the judicial agencies make sure that he never gets investigated. Like I said, we really only got some of the information on Comey we have because this interim appointment Pam Bondi made actually started doing some of the hard questions and asking the hard investigation. So it'd be great if the Senate could officially confirm that person to just have that job officially. But in the meantime, there's going to be just a ton of legal warfare over whether this interim appointment worked or not, as people definitely fight to keep someone that the district court's going to appoint who will refuse to go after James Comey.
I'll put a link to that article in the show notes, and I really would encourage you to take a look at that. This has been one of the big surprises to me, more in the UK, because I'm more familiar, just because I'm more familiar with that. And I have no doubt it's the same in the US. But it's like, you read the Bible, and the Bible has a lot of condemnation about judges and injustice and the law system. A whole lot to say about that. And I used to kind of wonder a bit, like, why? Why does it single out the judges rather than, say, politicians and leaders? And I think part of that is perhaps like biblical language. Certainly in Israel, judges were almost political leaders. There wasn't a lawmaker. There wasn't a legislature. You had kings and you had judges, kind of for the most part, I guess, governors and things as well. But I also, then since then, like, you start to look at the roots of so many of our problems, and it goes back to judges. Like, you look at some of the crazy things Britain's doing. Like, why people say, oh, I'm depressed, and the government says, here, we'll give you a new car at the taxpayer's expense. It's crazy, but that's because of judicial rulings. The judges rule, the government put in a law where they said, we want to help handicapped people with adjusted vehicles, and this law does not apply to people with mental disabilities. And the court struck that down. And then the government wrote the law again to kind of try and override the law. And then the court struck that down again. And at that point, the government just gave up. You have migration. Like, so much of that in the UK, and so much of the reasons why we have so many people and we're handing over vast fortunes to the upkeep of people that have come from other countries. And part of the reason why taxes were just raised this week to the highest level in history is because of insane decisions that judges have made on migrants. The latest this week was a German citizen could not be deported to Germany because his German wasn't good enough. And so therefore that would be some kind of violation of his human rights. And it's these judges taking comments that have not, they're completely out of context, vastly inflating them and making it impossible to deport people. So, and judges are at the roots of so many of our issues. This week, one of the other pieces of news from the UK, and I'm using this to shoehorn a few of these in, is that the government's talking about getting rid of jury trials. That, according to a leaked document, they want to get rid of jury trials because justice takes so long. And I mean, I sympathize definitely on that point. Like, that is something that needs to be fixed, that people face years between doing something and coming to court. And if you think about it, if somebody's innocent, well, they then can have a court case and all kinds of court proceedings hanging over their head for years before they can finally clear their name. I mean, that's the kind of the process is the crime that we saw against Donald Trump's appointees. You get tons of just ordinary people caught up in that. And then it means that criminals don't get punished promptly. And so they kind of feel like they've gotten away with it. They don't change. So that is something that needs to be fixed. But the idea of then just judges deciding all of these things, when we've had so many horrible decisions from judges all the time, I mean, that just seems like that could open the door to all kinds more abuse. So big problems in the judicial system in both countries. And that article really gets to the spiritual roots and God's anger at injustice. I mean, this is part of the reason why the Holy Roman Empire is rising up right now, and God is allowing that empire to rise up and everything that it's going to be allowed to do. It's to correct our countries. And one of those things we need to be corrected on is injustice. So, and there's very little change on that justice front, even though you've got a new government. It's going to take a longer time to make court reforms if they happen at all. So an important story to watch. What else did you have for us from the English-speaking world, Andrew?
Yeah, three other stories here in America. One is something that sadly we've kind of all known for a while, but finally got official confirmation on, where they had a government official come out and announce that Elon Musk's Department of Government Efficiency does not exist. This is something that, like, President Trump, like, just a couple days after he was elected, promised that by the 250th anniversary of American independence coming up in not this 4th of July, but next 4th of July, we were going to have a leaner, smaller, more efficient government, and then appointed Elon Musk and Vivek Ramaswamy to lead up a commission to, like, identify more than $1 trillion in government waste for cutting and slashing. Then we rolled around to the big, beautiful bill, and not only did we not cut any spending, we actually increased it, which pretty much made Elon Musk realize that he was wasting his time identifying government waste when no one was ever going to do anything about it. So he backed away from Doge, other people took over, And now we're officially knowing that it does not exist. And sadly, it looks like they're indeed not going to have a leaner, smaller, more cost-efficient government by America's 250th anniversary, about 18 months from now. Another story we have here that we actually just, I just finished help writing up for the Trumpet Brief this morning, is about two National Guardsmen in Washington, D.C., who were shot by a 29-year-old Afghan immigrant let into the nation under a Joe Biden program he enacted after his disastrous withdrawal from Afghanistan. One of those National Guards is already dead. The other one's in critical condition. Donald Trump has condemned the shootings as terrorism and made an announcement that he's pretty much freezing all immigration from third world countries until further notice. And then rightly pointed back blame to the Joe Biden administration for letting something like 190,000 people from Afghanistan into the United States who were barely vetted on grounds that, like, okay, well, we're withdrawing from Afghanistan, so the Taliban's taking over, we'll let people who've helped the American administration in the past come to the United States without actually vetting them at all to see, like, are they the type of person who's just going to pick up a gun 2 years later and or a couple years later and kill a couple National Guardsmen. So, yeah, definitely a big story to keep a look on there. Our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Foy, wrote an article at the time about the Afghan withdrawal, saying it's not incompetence, it's treason. It was a move the Barack Obama and Joe Biden took to deliberately weaken America. And then just following logically on from that statement, the move to let the 190,000 unvetted immigrants into the United States is another move to deliberately weaken America, which is taking place. And then one last story, this one from elsewhere in the English-speaking world, from Britain, where the Britain's National Health Services, it's actually chemically castrating children again. Some of those just really evil hormone treatments they've been giving to children who are nowhere near old enough to know what they're doing is something that there was some pushback on for a while, saying that we really shouldn't be giving like transgender treatments to those under age 18 years of age. And now the pushback pendulum swinging back into saying that the transgender movement's gotten a win there, saying that they actually should be taking children and giving them hormones that are really just going to mess up their bodies and the way they go through puberty.
Well, thank you very much for that, Andrew. For Europe this week, I wanted to talk about the German government spending the last week and even more fighting about pensions. But really, this isn't about pensions. This is about, can the German government succeed? Can it come together? And a big poll published in Bild a day or two ago basically showed that most Germans expect this coalition to fail. So we've reached the point now where most Germans have written off Friedrich Merz. They're expecting the government to fall, and they're expecting, I guess, early elections or more different coalition wranglings. So the immediate issue that's triggered a lot of this has been pensions. There have been coalition bust-ups before. There was one a few months ago over conscription and just even the way that that debate was carried out and how quickly would Germany move towards conscription. They haven't had a compromise there. This latest bit is an attempt to fix pensions at 48% of average earnings. This is a key social democrat requirement. The coalition, as part of the coalition agreement, agreed on that until 2031, but they're passing a law to fix it beyond 2031. And 18 members out of a 630-strong parliament have kind of chosen this as their hill to die on. They're all under the age of 35. They're members of the Christian Democratic Union or its sister party, the Christian Social Union. And they're saying no, because if you do this, their argument is, and the maths on this checks out. Like if you fix pensions, but you have the number of pensioners growing and the number of workers shrinking, which is what is happening in Germany, then you're just loading an ever larger burden on working people. The amount they have to pay towards pensions is just going to go up and up and up, and then the whole system will collapse before they get to claim any pensions of their own. So it's unfair. So that's their position. And the coalition, they've been arguing over this for weeks. They stayed up until I think it was 2 or 3 in the morning. The cabinet finally announced a deal where they said, we're moving forward with the law as is, but then next year we're going to have big discussions about a complete overhaul of the pension system that would apply from 2032 onwards. This is kind of still breaking-ish news, so I haven't managed to find anything about how the rebels have reacted to that. We probably will find out over the weekend. But again, in many ways, like I said, this isn't about pensions. This is about, I think we've reached a milestone in this new German government. And it's not a specific event. I can't say that milestone happened on the 23rd of November. But when Friedrich Merz was elected, he talked tough. He talked a big game. He said, we're going to have masses of reforms. He was, judged by words, the most reforming German chancellor that we've had in decades. And he came in and very quickly, I mean, even before the new government sat down, the constitution was changed to enable unlimited borrowing to spend military for military spending. That was a massive reform. And it was a popular reform. So that happened, and there have been incredible changes on the German military front. So people were looking at Merz and they're like, wow, you know, man of action. We had some movement here. What's next? And he talked a good game, and people were okay to give him a bit of time. And like, yeah, well, we just had some big developments on the military. And okay, he's pushing some more big developments on the military. Well, what's next? And now we're 6 months down the line and people are starting to think and realize, actually, there's nothing next. Actually, when it comes to not the military, 60% of Germans support what he's doing on the military. That is overwhelmingly popular. That in itself is a pretty big story. But when it comes to anything else, it's not happening. And people have given up. So this poll that was published in the Bild found that 54% of citizens said that Friedrich Merz's term in office would end prematurely. Only 29%, less than a third of Germans, believe he's going to last the full term. You know, the difference between those are people say, well, they don't know whether he's going to last. But less than a third think he's going to go the distance. Most people in the Christian Democratic Union, the Christian Social Union, expect he's going to fail. So we've reached a point where confidence is collapsing. Eurointelligence, they wrote about a week ago, we're not surprised that this coalition is acting the way it is. We had 3 grand coalitions under Angela Merkel, during which the country laid the foundation of its economic decline. Why would grand coalition number 4 be any different? They condemned Merz's, quote, lack of leadership quality, poor negotiating skill, and his tendency towards flippancy. They said, we're not ruling out that a future German government might pass reforms, but we can rule out that will happen under this coalition. We can also rule out that will happen under Merz, no matter what coalition he leads. I mean, the people at Eurointelligence are pretty influential journalists. Wolfgang Munchau, probably one of the best known, at least in the English-speaking world, German economic writers. And there he is saying, well, we've given up. They've given up. It's not just economic analysts giving up. Here's a clip from A Key of David that Mr. Flurry gave earlier in this year about who really rules Germany.
Who is leading Germany? Many people don't know. Most people don't. And if they did know, they would often be very frightened about how that government is run, and especially in this end time, more so than even in the past. But notice this. I want to give you this quote. Donald Tusk, a former president of the European Council and former prime minister of Poland, said he had a private conversation with Merkel about the Nord Stream 2 pipeline. Tusk called Merkel's public support of the pipeline her biggest mistake. But the most revealing thing he said was that she privately admitted to him that She was helpless to do otherwise because of pressure from German businesses. How about that? The German businesses have a lot of power, and we're going to go on to see here that they even overruled the Chancellor of Germany. This group of corporations, they have a lot of power.
German business leaders have a lot of power. Watch those German business leaders. Well, they're not happy. Volkswagen Group, Germany's biggest company, they posted their first loss since COVID-19. German business leaders are making their dissatisfaction felt. Just a few days after Mr. Flurry gave that Key of David, you had leaders from four top business associations hold a secret meeting with Merz. According to Bild, they, quote, gave the chancellor a thorough grilling for an hour and a half. And they said that the key demand made of Friedrich Merz was to pick up the pace on social reforms, reducing bureaucracy, modernizing the state. Then this month, 32 business associates signed a joint letter opposing these pension reforms. The fixing of the pension, I should say, at 48%, that's what they were opposed to. And then just this week, a group of family entrepreneurs, like a business group, they broke a major taboo by openly talking to the Alternative for Deutschland, this far-right group. I think that you've got a signal there from parts of the German business community. We're losing patience, we're getting fed up, and we have other options. And so they're willing to talk to this party that contains some neo-Nazis. So the reason why I want to draw attention to this story is this: we're watching Germany very closely for the rise of a strongman. And Mr. Flurry has constantly drawn attention to how coalition chaos could pave the way for that strongman. So it's very relevant that we're back to this coalition chaos. Just after Donald Trump was elected, Mr. Flurry had an article in the Trumpet print, "After Trump's Victory, Watch Germany." He said, "As dramatic as the fulfilled prophecy in America is, we also need to pay close attention to events in Germany." He said, "This nation's future is weak if something doesn't change." That's what we see still now. But Bible prophecy forewarns us that Germany is about to shock the world with its power. To accomplish this, it needs a strong leader, something it sorely lacks right now. He said that Germany's elections in February, quote, seem unlikely to solve Germany's leadership crisis. Polls suggest they'll only produce another weak, divided government. That's what we're seeing more and more clearly. Again, in that one area, military spending, it's been huge. In other areas, they're just as divided and weak as the one that came before. "There is a big leadership vacuum," wrote Mr. Flurry. "Germans know something dramatic must be done, and quickly. You see this in recent election results with the rise of fringe parties like the Alternative for Deutschland. Voters are showing themselves willing to embrace out-of-the-ordinary politics. They are clamoring for a strong leader." And business leaders are now joining in the clamor for a strong leader. And Mr. Flurry has repeatedly warned that you could have this strong leader come to power by taking advantage of a weak coalition. Here's a montage of where he said that.
Now, he's not going to come in by, let's say, a democratic process. He's going to come in and use flatteries and sort of tweak the democratic process, it says here, something like that, and perhaps take advantage of a weak coalition. But he's going to come in by flatteries. So God sees him, well, not the same way the people see him, but he actually gains that power, hijacks that European superpower by flatteries. He apparently puts together some kind of a small coalition, and that's how he moves into power. I mean, he is unusually adept at flattery. You have to be very intelligent to be able to deceive people in high places with flattery. And he does it magnificently. Well, he was never voted into the office, but he came in, got control of all that power through deceit and flatteries. Now, remember, this is an end-time book, and this is an end-time prophecy. It's going to happen again in this end time. A man is going to come, and through deceit and flatteries is going to get control of the Holy Roman Empire and its 10 toes or 10 kings, and not by voting, even though that is their system today It is not going to, he's going to come in another way.
And he made all of those forecasts, as you even heard a bit there, because of Daniel 11. Daniel and Daniel 8, Daniel 11 and verse 21 talks about this coming leader who will not be given, quote, the honor of the kingdom. He doesn't come to power in the usual way, but instead he'll obtain the kingdom by flatteries. The stage is all set for that strong leader, and Germany is already having this rapid, incredible military transformation. So you have this military power being built up, and we're just waiting for the strong man. And the Catholic Church is going to play a role with that strong man, and I think you can see, and then the strong man will help play a role in bringing unity to the Catholic Church. So we are really living in urgent prophetic times. That is what all of these news stories point to. Now is the time to act. Now is the time to dig into the Bible, to study Bible prophecy, to use that to then build your relationship with God. Now, Bible prophecy points to the incredible power of God's word, that it is a two-edged sword, that it cuts, that it corrects, that it shows us how and where we need to change our lives. So we have various different bits of material in the show notes. We can also link to A Strong German Leader is Imminent. We'd be very happy to send any of those to you for you to dig into, to study, because they show what's coming next, and the Bible gives us the only sure hope for the future as well. It explains why these curses are coming upon the world. And so we really want to share that warning and share that hope with you. Well, that is about all we've got time for. Thank you very much to all of our contributors today. Those of you may have spotted that Jeremiah Jacques was taking a bit of an extended Thanksgiving break, but he'll be back with us on Friday next week. And then we'll also have our regular Week in Review show on Wednesday. Thank you to George Haddad for engineering and production. We'll be back, like I said, on Wednesday. Until then, keep watching your world.